Welcome to Built to Go, a van life podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Wagg, coming to you from the College of Curiosity. This time it's episode 267, and we're going to share a story with you, not a tale from the road, a tale of the road, a tale about the road. One person's van life journey summed up. We're also going to talk about a way to clean your dishes without using any water at all, as tested in Africa. A product review of a thing that can help figure out where your leaks are coming from. And a map that is very important to some folks. But hello, welcome back. Thank you very much for letting me take an unannounced week off last week. I appreciate that. I was having an adventure. Yay! And I will tell you about the adventure I was having later in this podcast. But first, there is some very important business to take care of, and that is this. Ladies and gentlemen, that was a can of hams. Hams is the beer refreshing, and no, this does not count as a advertisement because I am not hired by Hams. In fact, Hams, for those who aren't aware, Hams is like one of these really cheap beers that doesn't come in a 6-pack or a 12-pack or even a 24-pack. It comes in a 30-pack. Yeah, it's one of those beers. But it is pretty refreshing, and it's a beer I've come to like. It's a very old brand. And in the Chicagoland area, it was available everywhere, or pretty close to everywhere. It was very common, at any rate. And lately, it has disappeared. None of the bars have it anymore. It's hard to find in stores. And it's just weird. I don't know why. I don't know if people stopped drinking it. Most people I know preferred it to Pabst Blue Ribbon, which was another cheap beer that people drink. And instead, it seems to have been replaced by Yuengling, which is a beer from further east, like Pennsylvania area. And that beer is everywhere. And it just made me realize that this is all just marketing stuff. It's, why does your bar have this beer? Because some sales rep came in and said, hey, I'll give you half off for 6 months if you carry my beer and nobody else's, or something like that. I might be getting a little bit cynical in my old age, but for today and for this podcast, I have a Hams. And none of that has anything to do with anything, except that I just ate a whole bunch of peanuts and I couldn't talk and I needed something and the Hams was there. So thank you, Hams. I appreciate you. Okay, this podcast was handed to me by a couple of people who just sent me really good things. And in fact, the first one here wasn't sent to me. I'm literally stealing it with permission. But it was so good and so poignant and just kind of summed up van life in one Facebook post, is what it was, that I have to share it with you. So what I'm about to read to you was written by a woman by the name of Liz James. And I've talked about Liz on this podcast before. She is a person who had a van named Squeaky, and she told us the story of Squeaky's last ride, which was very sad. And Liz is also the person who came up with the idea that in a van, it's not a sink that you need, but a drain. And now I've talked to her about that, and it seems that we kind of collaborated on that idea somehow. It's whatever. We both had thoughts on it, and therefore was born the concept that you need a drain and not a sink. And then she came on one of my trips recently down the Danube River, and we got to spend some time there. And anyway, she is a very interesting person, and I say that as someone who has met a lot of interesting people. And she is not a UU minister. She is a UU preacher. Let's back up a little bit here. UU stands for Unitarian Universalist. It is a church, and it's an interesting church because it's a church that has no creed. You do not need to believe any set of things to be a member of their church. If you believe in God, great. If you don't believe in God, great. That isn't what's important. For this particular church, and it's a very large and very old church. This isn't some fringe thing at all. What matters is who you are and how much goodwill you have, basically. I mean, I'm not a UU person, so I shouldn't be speaking for them, but that's the idea I get from it. And Liz is from Canada, so she is a Canada UU, and there are some differences between the Canadian UU ministry and the United States UU ministry. It's fascinating history, very New England-y history, and believe it or not, part of that history involves the Puritans. Remember the Pilgrims came over and they were all like, no dancing, oh no, you know, very, very prudish. Their heritage basically is part of the UU history, and they're gone. You know, there aren't any Puritans anymore, and I can tell you that the UUs are not prudish, not at all. If you are ever looking for a sex-positive church, let me introduce you to the UUs, and you might have to shop around from congregation to congregation because they don't all do the same thing. With that backstory, I would like to read you this story that Liz wrote about her adventures in van life. And Liz went to van life because she was basically an itinerant preacher. She would go from church to church and preach, and the van was the most economical way. It would provide her shelter and transportation, etc. One thing Liz is very articulate and an excellent writer, and so you will know that these are not my words that I'm reading. But from this point on, I am quoting Liz. Touring and van life are a skill, and the first year I did it, I was half in awe and half just trying to keep my head above water. Like so many things, you get better at van life as you go. Unlike house life, you don't usually get a chance to be taught as a child, so there's definitely a learning curve. This year, it all clicked. Things that made this year's tour so great. Number one, humans. The way I do it, van life, is very relational. This year, one of the things on my New Year's bingo card, it's another story, was to ask 7 people who intimidate me to hang out. They all said yes. It was stunning. Number two, epic hikes. I used All Trails a lot until Lindsay taught me to use AI, which is phenomenally helpful with travel planning. I scheduled most travel days around an absolutely epic hike. I saw redwoods and both coasts and mountaintops and perhaps more of the Grand Canyon than was good for me. Hot tip, the way back out is quite a bit more difficult. All those signs that the ranger posts behind the trail saying, warning, the way back out is quite a bit more difficult? Yeah, true story. Number three, Planet Fitness. It was my nightly pilgrimage for showering and doing dishes and desk work on the Wi-Fi. Due to social pressures to fit in, I even lifted weights, and now I'm wildly strong. Note, it is interesting to me that social pressure inspired me to exercise, but did not inhibit me from doing my dishes in the shower stall at the gym. Number four, cook like you are in a van. The first year I tried to replicate home meals. Now I cook a more limited repertoire of road food. Breakfast was almost always oatmeal like you'd eat when hiking, fruit and eggs I'd batch boiled. Lunch was cut fruits and salad veggies and a protein shake, because of all the social pressure from going to the gym so much. Supper was usually a really lovely meal, either out with friends or something I cooked in the 12-volt oven as I drove. What can you make in a 12-volt oven? Scones and fresh bread and corn and rice and beans and most meats. And you can reheat pretty much anything, so I did a lot of cooking and prep in houses. Number five, a van is not where you live, it's where you sleep. The only needs I met inside the van were sleep, storage, driving, and some rudimentary food prep. The rest of the time, I was out in the world with congregations, hiking, seeing sights, hanging out with friends, working in the library, or at a Planet Fitness. If you were going to do your living inside, I recommend a house. If you want to live in the world, I recommend a van. All of this has resulted in a transition that is hard to describe. It used to be that my schedule was so full. It was packed with tidying and chores and activities and a constant sense of guilt and shoulds. On the road, there is usually only one thing I can be doing. The hike in front of me, the conversation I'm having, or the meal I'm eating. The next turn in the road. Every part of my life encourages me to sink into the moment, and also to lift weights. It used to be that my sense of self was so large, it contained the house we lived in as a family, a mountain of stuff and accompanying chores, and even the city I called home. After 2 years of much time on the road, I have now come back home to find that it is just one more part of the world I live in. Who I am, that is so much smaller and bigger than a single place. It is the body I've been focused on moving and caring for, the relationships I've had more time to sink into, and the tiny phone filled with conversations, photos, and writing that comes with me everywhere I go. It feels simple and free, and in its own way, it feels like home. That is a van life story. That is what van life's about. Oh, it's me again, by the way. Yeah, once I said that, it was me. Liz is gone now. Liz is actually going to be in Boston as this is published, so I know where she is. But yes, that to me, that is just exactly how to do it, folks. The van is a tool. It lets you live your life. There are many other ways you can live your life. There are many other tools, but a van is one that lets you live your life in a certain way. And boy, the whole part that she talked about where I can only do this one thing. Freedom is a tyranny, and reducing your freedom by your choice, not by coercion or someone else's rules, actually gives you more freedom. Artists limit themselves to one medium, usually. A writer writes. They don't paint. That's a limit they've put on themselves. To express an idea, a writer is going to use words. A painter is going to use paints. And only very rarely will they cross. Those limits can be enabling and empowering. And van life gives you some limits that can do the same thing. I am perhaps getting a wee bit too philosophical here, but I did want to share that bit with you, and I'm sure that will resonate with some of you. And others, you're probably like, what does this have to do with vans? And there's no right or wrong response. However, I would like to say one last thing. If you are on Facebook, there's a Facebook group called the UU Hysterical Society that is this massive group that basically shares funny memes. I mean, that's basically what they do. But it's a group that's managed in a different way, and they create some of their own humor, and it is one of the bright spots on the internet today. And Liz founded that. And you can check that out on Facebook. Just search UU Hysterical Society, and what you will find is you've been exposed to them all along because you've been seeing their stuff being shared widely. And that's where it came from. So thank you, Liz, for letting me share that with folks. I think that was a beautiful encapsulation of what van life can be. And I hope that's inspiring and also a bit of a mirror for other folks who didn't realize all the things you realized, but are actually experiencing those things for themselves. A special thanks to everyone who has bought me a gallon at buymeacoffee.com/built2go. You are the reason there are no ads on this podcast. Thank you all very much, especially to the folks who donate every month. If you would like to help contribute to the distinct lack of advertising on this podcast, please visit buymeacoffee.com/built2go. That's 2 T's, not 3, not 1. And you too may be one of those special people who have said no ads. And we will all appreciate you for that. Thank you. Tech Talk. So this next bit is also from a listener, and I think it's fascinating. And this person goes to Africa for their version of Burning Man. And I'm going to keep them anonymous, but their name is John. That's fairly anonymous. But at Burning Man, if you've not been, and I haven't been, water is a very, very scarce resource. You have to bring in all your own water, and you have to bring out all your own water too, typically. You can't just dump gray water on the ground. So water is a big deal, water in and water out. And if you can get away with using less water, that is a good thing. I just talked about this a couple of podcasts ago, and John had this response. Was just listening to your most recent podcast episode and was very interested in your discussion of water as a resource. I've discovered a way to do dishes without using any water whatsoever. I have been to Africa Burn 5 times in the last several years. Like Burning Man, the event is held in a remote area and there is no water available on site, so a full week's worth of drinking and washing water must be hauled in, and conserving it is essential. Furthermore, one of the 10 principles of Burning Man is to leave no trace. This makes the disposal of dirty wash water very challenging, since it would be unacceptable to simply pour it out on the ground, leaving food particles and other contaminants behind. The way I have avoided this is to first wipe pots, pans, dishes, and utensils with paper towels to remove any food clinging to them. That's a very good tip there. Note that this is critical to do this right away before the food hardens. Step 2 is to then clean and sanitize the dishes using alcohol wipes. It is important to use wipes that contain ethanol, which is non-toxic, and nothing else such as soap or added perfumes. I use these, Magic Care Sanitizer Wipes, and I will have the link he shared in the show notes. You simply throw the paper towels and alcohol wipes away. Dishes clean and sanitized with no water used. As an aside, I use 120-proof grain alcohol in my travel spray bottles for similar reasons. It is strong enough to kill bacteria, but non-toxic, so it can be sprayed on food, like fruit, if a source of clean water wash is not immediately available. Plus, I have found that it smells better than other alcohols. I came up with this hack during the pandemic, when isopropyl alcohol was sold out everywhere, but grain alcohol was readily available in most liquor stores. Well, thank you, John. I think that's fascinating. And I have a couple things to say about this. First, your tip on wiping out the dishes right away. Oh, that is so important. And I absolutely should have mentioned that earlier, especially if you're using the frying pan. So when the frying pan is still hot, one way to clean it, like just be done with it, is to wipe it out with a damp paper towel or a wet one. Again, talking about water, you're not supposed to be using water, but still, wipe that out as soon as you can. Don't burn yourself, obviously, but that's going to be the easiest, simplest way to do it. Now remember, your frying pan is essentially self-sterilizing because it gets so hot that nothing could live through that, but you still want to get all the food and stuff off of it, and a quick wipe is the best way to do that. Wipe off as much as you can and then throw that away. Now, I know, then you're using a paper towel and say, well, that's a waste of paper. I should be using a cloth that you can wash, but oh, wait, washing uses water. Yeah, you see the situation. You're trying to do the best with what resources you have. So that is excellent. Second thing, using ethanol alcohol wipes is a great idea, but we have to talk about this a little bit more. Wet naps, as they are sometimes called, I think that's a brand name, the little packages of hand wipes that you get after you eat barbecue ribs or lobster or something like that, not the same thing. You want to use something, like John says, that doesn't have any perfumes or any scents or anything like that, but you also don't want anything that has isopropanol in it, because that is a poisonous alcohol. It's fine to put on your skin, but if you drink it, you could have serious problems. You definitely want to find something that has just ethanol in it, which is why he has the link here that I will have in the show notes. Ethanol is, it's the alcohol in my hands right here. Ethanol is the alcohol that people drink when they're drinking alcohol. No other kind of alcohol will do. Some of them smell similar, some of them even taste good, but they can be deadly. If you're curious about that, read the Poisoner's Handbook, which was a book written about what happened during Prohibition, when the United States government said, well, alcohol still has industrial use. How do we stop people from drinking it? Oh, I know. Let's put poison in it. And that's exactly what they did, leading to tens of thousands of deaths. So don't mess around with that. The grain alcohol thing is interesting. Grain alcohol is an interesting substance. It's not always easy to find. It's illegal in some places because it is so much alcohol. 120-proof grain alcohol is 60%, so that is a lot, and it is just at the bottom edge of the range for disinfecting. See, it turns out the percentage of alcohol in a disinfectant alcohol matters. If it's too low or too high, it won't be as effective. 60 is at the low end, and I think 80 is where the high end is. If you use alcohol that's higher than 80, what happens is that some organisms will become spores. Like, I believe noro is like this. The alcohol will contact the norovirus and it will become a spore and it will survive. But it only does that if the alcohol content is so high that it doesn't have a chance to absorb the water in there and burst. I think that's how it works. Noro's a little bit different. You need some citric acid in there to soften the coat. I'm getting way too detailed on this. But anyway, what you want to do for this is use ethanol, 60 to 80% solution. So that would be 120 to 160 proof if you're using grain alcohol. You can also find something called kosher ethanol. I have seen this a few times. I do not know what needs to be done to make it kosher, but you can make cocktails with it and you can clean your dishes with it and yourself. Stuff is very, very, very flammable. And so are the vapors. And another risk here is that when the vapors catch fire, they're invisible. So you want to be very careful not to expose this to open flames. Like, you know, don't clean your frying pan with this, like, while your frying pan is on the burner that's lit. That would be bad. Don't do that. But these are great tips, and he absolutely cleans his dishes. They're perfectly clean, safe to use, and didn't use any water. And if you're in a circumstance where water is that precious, this is something to consider. I'll have his link in the show notes for the Magic Care sanitizer wipes. And, you know, it's just food for thought. Measure your own situation. If water's plentiful, you don't have to go through all this. If water isn't plentiful, this is another way you can get by. And thank you, John. Excellent, excellent comments. Product review. So I have told you the story of my truck camper, which I have made progress on. I have a plan. Not just the thought of a plan. I have an actual plan. And I've actually done some work on it. I've removed all the rot from one side, and I've put a plank in kind of as the strong part that everything else can be built off of. And it's going to be fine. It's going to be fine. I just haven't had time to finish it up. The weather has not been cooperating, sadly, and I've been traveling, but whatever, it doesn't matter. You'll hear more about that later. But when you have rot, when you have water damage in your rig, it's very, very, very important to figure out where that water's coming from. And in the case of my rig, and in many rigs, it's not like it's just dripping down the walls. The water's in the walls, and you can't necessarily see it. In my rig, the walls look fine. You'd never guess there was something going on behind them. Except at the very bottom, you can see it's kind of like it's almost like a luan, a very thin wood that's covered with a paper. Down at the very bottom where the seats are, the paper is a little bit loose and wrinkly, so you can tell something happened. But how do you tell where the water's coming in if you can't see it? Well, you use one of these things. This is a moisture meter. It's a little handheld device, kind of the same size as a remote control. Comes in a bunch of different colors. Mine happens to be red. And there's two different ways it works. But you can think of it kind of like a stud finder. It detects how much electricity flows from one point to another inside the device. And using that, it can tell how moist something is. Now, these devices are a little bit more complicated than that. You do have to set them up properly. They need to know what kind of wood you have in order to get an accurate reading and things like that, because they work also on density, and denser wood need to have a different setting than less dense woods, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But for our purposes here, where we're just trying to see where the water gets in, that stuff isn't as important. Basically, you want it to be able to tell you if there's water there or not. That's it. And I didn't spend that much time learning how to use it. Once I got to the point that I could get it to make a noise when it detected water, then that was all I needed. So these will do a lot more than how I used it. This model that I am recommending here can use pins or not pins. The traditional ones of these had pins. They were very sharp pins, and they were sticking out of the top of the unit, and you would basically stab them into the wood to tell if there's moisture there, or stab them into the drywall or the wallpaper or whatever. But of course, this makes holes. So there's a way that you can use this thing without the stabbing that will do the same thing. And that works just fine. So in my rig, what I was able to find out was that the wettest part was at the bottom of the wall, which was not surprising at all, and that it was perfectly dry above the windows. There was no moisture at all above the windows, which means the roof is fine, And then when I got below the window, I found moisture. But when I went below the window and then to either side, there was much less moisture. And so, yeah, my windows are leaking just like I thought. But now I know that's what it is, and I didn't have to tear down walls or unscrew the windows or open up the ceiling or anything like that. And I'll tell you what, for $20, which is all this thing cost, it was worth it. So if you are doing something where you have a water problem, or if you're just curious about how wet things are getting in your van because of normal humidity, etc., this moisture meter might actually be something that you want. Now, they make 900 bazillion of these things. The one I got is just a plain old cheap one that had good reviews. You can certainly get fancier ones. You can get less fancy ones. This one worked fine, so I'm going to recommend it. But yeah, it's only $20 on Amazon. And you can also use it to tell if your wood is too wet to burn. Like if you're going to have a fire and you've got some chopped wood and, is this wood seasoned enough? You're not sure. Well, the moisture meter can help you with that too. You might find all kinds of other uses for it. But for me, $20 was a very low price to pay to figure out exactly where the water was getting into my rig. There is a link in the show notes. A place to visit. This is going to be a place to visit kind of combined with a tale from the road here, because I'm going to tell you about my recent adventure to, of all places, Sandwich, Massachusetts. Why on earth would anybody go to Sandwich, Massachusetts? Well, I'll tell you. The reason I was there is because I had tickets to see one of these massive 80s shows with all these different bands. It was like my record collection as a youth. I saw The Vapors, Big Country, Icicle Works, China Crisis, Peter Godwin, General Public, A Flock of Seagulls, The Polecats, Josie Cotton. I mean, there were so many bands. Then they're not listening, so they won't mind that I missed one or two. But it's a big, huge show, and I really wanted to go. But then my wife and I were talking, and she said, well, hey, she would like to come with me on the trip. She didn't want to go to the show. And I was like, oh, well, okay. I mean, New Haven, you know, home of Yale and the Voynich manuscripts. There's stuff to do there, and it's not too far from Mystic, Connecticut. We could have pizza, and Connecticut's a fascinating state. There's lots of stuff to see in Connecticut. But, you know, I used to work on Cape Cod way back in the day, back in the late 80s, and I don't think I've been back since. Maybe once. And I thought, you know, what if we just went to Cape Cod? Then we talked about it, and sure, she thought that was a great idea. And so Sandwich, Mass is right at the very top of Cape Cod, where Cape Cod attaches to the rest of the state. There is a canal called the Cape Cod Canal, that separates Cape Cod from the rest of the state. And Sandwich is directly on the northern western part of the canal, almost where Plymouth is, except the canal separates the two. So if you make a crook in your arm and your head is Boston, Sandwich is where your shoulder is. That's terrible, but it's the best I can come up with. Anyway, Sandwich is very, very old. It was founded in 1637, which for most folks in the U.S. sounds like a really old place, and for most folks in Europe sounds like, it's kind of old. In Chicago, that's very old. I grew up in Salem, Mass., which was founded in 1626, so, 1637. Well, you had 11 years to get there. Anyway, whatever images you have of Cape Cod, they are probably not accurate when it comes to Sandwich. Sandwich is a very old colonial New England town that really hasn't changed all that much in a long time. There are some buildings from the 17th century there. There are a few buildings from the 18th century, a whole lot of buildings from the 19th century, and then not so many from the 20th century. There are some, but not all that many, and probably none from the 21st century. One of those buildings from the 20th century, although it was from 1901, was a church. And that church had been deconsecrated. It was a Catholic church that the Catholics decided they didn't want anymore for whatever reason. And a gentleman bought it and turned it into a hotel. And how do you turn a church into a hotel? Well, he just kind of carved it up. And the room we stayed in is called the Tuesday Room, because there are six rooms. It's kind of funny. There are six rooms in the church. Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday. And then there's a door that says Sunday on it. But it, if you open that door, you're actually outside. It's like to leave the church. Like, I don't know. Anyway, I found it funny. But we stayed in the Tuesday room. And the Tuesday room is fantastic because the Tuesday room is up in the air. And the entire room is the round stained glass rosette that was the centerpiece of the church. I'll have a picture in the show notes. But we basically were sleeping right in the window of this massive, probably 12 foot in diameter stained glass window. It was really, really cool. And then in the where the pews would be in a church, that was a restaurant, a bistro, kind of expensive, but pretty good. And then there was another, like an alcove area that had kind of a sitting area with coffee. It was a really, really nice place to stay. It's called the Belfry Inn, B-L-F-R-Y-I-N-N, in Sandwich, Mass. Beautiful, wonderful place to stay. Next door was one of these pink lady kind of Victorians with all the gingerbread on it. That used to be the rectory, and that also had rooms in it, but it was also where we had breakfast, which was included. And in the lunchtime and dinner time, it was a burger bar, which had some pretty good food, too. And in fact, this whole street was things like this. It was repurposed buildings made for your pleasure. There was a storefront that was another restaurant that had excellent oysters. There's an old carriage house that had storefronts in it. And the whole town is what I remember tourism to be like. You'd go and you'd stay in the town, and the tourism wasn't the town. The town was the town, and you were visiting for a while to see the town. And the town didn't cater to you. The town wasn't like, oh, tourists are everything. No, the town was the town. You were invited to stay for a while and experience the town. And you got to do that in Sandwich. It had these cute little stores. Like, there was a store called The Weather Store. And while they didn't sell weather, so far as I'm aware, they did sell really nice weather equipment, like anemometers and wind vanes and thermometers and a few nautical things. Just really cool boutique-y store that wasn't just a cookie cutter of every other store. There were some interesting clothing stores. There's a glass museum for the glass factory that used to be in Sandwich. It turns out long, long ago, an entrepreneur in Boston built a glass factory in Sandwich, hoping that the sand there would be useful for glass. The place is named Sandwich after Sandwich, England. It is not named for the sand there, but there is sand there, so, you know, it kind of fits. But that sand is not good for glass blowing, so it was never used. In fact, currently they use glass from the Czech Republic, but they did put the factory there also in anticipation of the canal being built, which it wasn't during the factory's lifetime. It did come later. However, even though the factory is long gone, Sandwich has been known as a glassblower's haven for years, and there's all these little glassblowing shops, and again, this amazing museum. Now, I've been to a lot of museums. I kind of look at museums differently than a lot of people now. I don't actually go to see what the exhibits are about. I go to see how the exhibits are done. I really enjoy seeing how someone said, "Let us display this object in our museum," and how they designed the exhibit around that. And I have never seen more creative stuff than at this glass museum. I mean, it's glass. What are you going to do with it? You're going to put it in a glass case and very carefully light it, or you're not going to put it in a case at all. No. They did far more interesting things than that here. And I'm not going to spoil it, but if you ever do go to Sandwich, Mass., make sure you go to the glass museum, watch them blow some glass, look at all the examples of the glass, but take a moment to look at how these exhibits are created and all the work that went into showing you just the right way to explain what this glass is and how it works. And some of them are interactive. There's this one big exhibit that's a glassblower studio from the turn of the last century, and it's haunted. And I say that because there's apparently a ghost in there, and as you go and walk through here, things move as though there's a person in there. There's even one point at which someone sneezes and a tissue kind of ripples on the counter. Just, why is that in a glass museum? I don't know, but it really added to the experience. So I can't say enough good things about that. But again, this is a town. It's not for tourists. We went to the Packy. What's a Packy? If you're from Massachusetts, you know what that is. But for the rest of the world, a Packy is a package store. It's a liquor store. In Massachusetts, at least until fairly recently, you couldn't buy beer, wine, or any liquor anywhere except in a licensed store. Now, these were not state stores. These were specially licensed stores, and that's what they sold. And they were called package stores because at one time it was illegal to carry a bottle of alcohol that wasn't wrapped up like a package. So it was called a package store because you would buy your beer or wine or whatever, they would wrap it in craft paper, and you would walk out with it. And, of course, people from Massachusetts always wanting to abbreviate everything if they became Packies. But we went to the Packy in town, and there was not a touristy thing about this Packy. This was just a regular old liquor store serving the community, and it was nice. That's what I wanted to see. You know, I didn't want to have tourism thrown at me all the time. And there's so few places left that are like this. Everyone is all about optimizing those tourist dollars. What do tourists want? I mean, there's so many examples of this, but one of them is Coco Cay. Perfect Day at Coco Cay, you may have heard of this. It's Royal Caribbean's private island. They took this idyllic island in the Berry Islands, which is part of the Bahamas, that had a crazy history about pirates and merchants and shipwrecks and all kinds of things, and erased it and turned it into basically a Disneyfied slab with water parks and pools and bars and restaurants. And why do you have to go to the Bahamas for that? You could go anywhere for that. And that's kind of my point. Sandwich has none of that. It has old churches with steeples, including one that was on the cover of an Elvis Presley album. One of the most photographed churches in the United States is in Sandwich. It has an old mill that was built in the 17th century, and it's still working. You can still go in there and get cornmeal that was ground on this ancient mill with the mill pond and the sluiceway, and it was delightful. Now, it didn't hurt that the weather had turned. You know, if you were around this area last week, you know it was oppressively hot and humid, and then suddenly it turned really nice for a few days. I understand that that has ended now, and it's miserable again, but being there in that weather was wonderful. They also had a town well. It was actually not too far from the mill. There was this well or spring that was just pouring out water. It was free to everybody. And it was such good water that all the residents would come and line up and fill up bottles to take them home to drink this water because it was so good. And yeah, sure, if you had a van, you could absolutely go fill up your van, fill up 50 gallons worth. It was free. Really high quality water from the aquifer. It's called the Cape Cod Aquifer. It's really good, good water. One last thing I'll tell you about, and then I'm going to make a meta statement, is they also have a fish hatchery. And it's open to the public. It's completely free. It's an open-air fish hatchery where they're basically breeding all different kinds of salmon and trout to stock ponds and rivers in the state. And it's an impressive facility, but I noticed it was a little bit old. So I asked one of the workers, you know, how old is this? I mean, was it built in the 50s? And he said, yeah, it was the 1850s. It's the oldest fish hatchery in the United States. And they've been raising fish since then. And they used water out of the aquifer. And he felt a little bad because they use like 1,000 gallons a minute. And all that water just ends up in the canal. It's a single use. But, it, you know, whereas in Arizona, that would be the greatest tragedy ever. In Massachusetts, there's so much water that that isn't as big of a deal. Plus, eventually that water is going to end up back in the aquifer because that's how the water cycle works. Their biggest problem with the fish hatchery? Otters. Otters come up the stream that's next to the property and sneak in and eat through the nets and grab a fish and take off. Well, I mean, it was just nice and fun, and it was exactly what I needed after spending so much time and all the glitz and glamour and all that. It was nice and simple. And so the big question is, why does Sandwich, Mass, which is on Cape Cod, a very touristy place, why does it get preserved where other places get completely overrun with flavor-of-the-day tourism? And the answer is very simple. Money. money. There's lots and lots of money in this town. The people who live there are very, very wealthy. You cannot get a home in Sandwich for less than $1 million. And that would be a very, very modest home, what they would call a half cape, basically one bedroom, one bath. These homes have been in the same families for generations. There's lots of money backing them up, and they have a lot of power to keep things exactly the way they are. That weather store, it's not paying the bills. It might be. I would seriously doubt it. In fact, the hours at the weather store were by chance or by appointment. I mean, it might be open. Go ahead and go down. And if he's there, yeah, come on in. But, you know, it might not be. That isn't how you run a business to make money. That's how you run a business because that's what you want to do. Anyway, I am not one of these wealthy people that could ever afford to live in Sandwich. But it was very nice to just enter that world for a little while and to just see a place that was welcoming and yet wasn't altered very much by my presence. It seems a rare thing. And then, of course, I have to add, what if you wanted to do van life in Sandwich or on the Cape in general? And sadly, it's very difficult. Very difficult. Parking is expensive everywhere. If you can find it at all the beaches that are anywhere near the mainland of Massachusetts fill up by 10 o'clock in the morning. There's no parking at any of them, and it costs money even if you could find parking. And then if you go far enough out to like Cape Cod National Seashore, you will probably find parking. But at that point, you could have a 4-hour traffic jam back to the, it just gets complicated and messy, and I don't know, it's not the same thing. Sadly, I don't think Cape Cod is great for van life. If you are going to do van life on Cape Cod, it's probably worth it to invest in a campground, and then you'll have a great time. Have a place to park, have a place to go at night, and then explore to your heart's content. If you get a place that's in the middle, like right by the elbow, you can get there from just about anywhere else on the Cape in an hour, so you can see whatever you want. You can go to the Whydah Pirate Museum, you can go to the Gory House, you can go to Provincetown, the seashore. There's so many things to see, and you won't have any worries about where you're going to park. So I had a great time. It was very nice to be there with my wife. We got to do all kinds of little romantic things and just see things, and it was super, super nice. But I have to acknowledge the fact that the only reason we could even do this is because a lot of people with a lot of money let us. Resource recommendation. So, ICE. Yeah, not that ICE. The U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE. You may have heard that they just received more funding than the U.S. Marines. What does an organization that is law enforcement do with a lot more money? They hire more people and they do more things. And how does that affect van life? Well, these folks have special rights that regular police don't. And some of them are in very gray areas. And that means that if they want to mess with you, they can and will. And whether it's enforced in the courts after the fact, you don't know. But meanwhile, you could have been in detention for 3 weeks waiting to find out. And so, okay, who is affected by ICE? Well, technically, the only two times that they can mess with you are at a border when you're trying to cross. That makes sense. Or if they have probable cause to think that you are not in the country legally. And that's the problem. What exactly does that look like? What is probable cause? Now, my heritage is mostly Canadian, so I look like a Canadian. I don't think they're going to stop me. But my friends from Venezuela, or Brazil, or Mexico, or any number of the Caribbean islands, or Indonesia, those folks, they're probably going to get stopped because the probable cause in the officer's mind is they're not white. Now, this is not a politics podcast, and that isn't actually what I'm going to talk about. I'm just trying to make the point that ICE can stop you if they have in their mind that they have probable cause. But there's a restriction on that. For example, if you are in central Utah, ICE can't just stop you. In fact, ICE can't operate there unless they have a warrant or something like that. But without a warrant, they are restricted to 100 miles from the border. And that sounds pretty reasonable, doesn't it? I mean, it's 100 miles from the border. There's only, you know, if you drive south from Canada, you're out of that range in 90 minutes or an hour and a half or 2 hours, you know. Yeah, no, that isn't how it is. So the resource recommendation here is a map. And I actually have a page from Reason Magazine at reason.com. This is definitely a political magazine with a certain slant. I don't necessarily share their views or beliefs. I happen to know a couple of the guys that work there. That's all a long story. So I'm just picking this magazine because it's a very clear illustration and it shows the issue. And basically, this 100-mile border that they've created, it includes a whole lot more than you might think. In fact, 2/3 of the people in the United States live within this 100-mile border. And you're probably thinking, well, that doesn't make any sense. It does when you look at the map. Because within 100 miles of the border, and you have to understand that any water, any ocean is considered border, entire states are engulfed in that 100 miles. For example, the entire state of Maine, of New Hampshire, Massachusetts, Rhode Island, Connecticut, New Jersey, Maryland, Delaware, Michigan, and Florida. All of those states are completely within that 100-mile zone. There is no place in those states where ICE can't just stop you and search you and your vehicle with quote-unquote probable cause. And that's a lot. Half of Texas, more than half of California, a big, huge portion of Oregon, including where everybody lives, and almost the entire state of Washington, also because of the way they draw the borders. Nearly all of Wisconsin, Chicago, and a great swath of area around Chicago. Why? Because Lake Michigan is considered a border. Lake Michigan does not touch Canada. I mean, you can get to Canada through Lake Michigan. You can go up and, you know, go under the bridge and yeah. But the way they drew this map, they decided that Lake Michigan counts because it is connected by water to Canada. Therefore, you can almost go all the way to Springfield, which is in the middle of the state in Illinois, and still be affected by ICE. So I say this just to bring this to your attention. I don't necessarily have any great advice for what to do here. Oh, by the way, Hawaii, too, obviously, is completely under ICE jurisdiction, according to them. Just know that if you are stopped by ICE, they have different rights than the police. And there's a huge gray area about how much power they have right now. What they do have is a lot of funding, and they have the support of the federal government in a way that they've never had before. So, I don't know. If you're the kind of person who does not want ICE to mess with your life, you're probably going to be better off staying in states like Nevada, Utah, Colorado, Kansas, Missouri, Nebraska, Wyoming, Arkansas, Kentucky, Tennessee. Yeah, that's about it. Oh, and Iowa and South Dakota. Those are the states that don't have any ICE presence. Everybody else does. And if they have a warrant, they can go wherever they want, but that's a different situation. So anyway, take a look at the resource, take a look at the map, and just see how much influence ICE has. And I want you to know one thing about this article, one of the reasons I picked it. It's from 2007. This is not new. What's new is how ICE is being unleashed on us. Well, folks, thank you very much for listening to episode 267, and thank you for letting me have a week off last week. That was wonderful. Music, as always, is by Simon Wagg, and if you need to get a hold of me for any reason, I am jeff@builttogo.com. That's 2 T's, not 3, not 1. Until next time, remember the words of Liz James, who said, "If you are going to do your living inside, I recommend a house. If you want to live in the world, I recommend a van."